So today, we scheduled a discussion about Budapest. Many of you in this room are familiar with the story of Hungarian Jews. I would say probably everybody in this room is familiar with the story about Hungarian Jews and the deportations of Hungarian Jews late in the war. So I actually do not want to talk about the history of Hungarian Jews in general. I want to talk about the story of a book from Budapest. The reason I chose Budapest for the story is because this book was published in Budapest, and the book brings together two stories of people, two individuals who I'd like to introduce to you today, who represent very fascinating ideas and developments when you talk about resistance during the Holocaust, and specifically this type of resistance. It's spiritual resistance, but it's also political resistance, as we'll see in a little bit, coming from the religious community, which is something that's often not discussed or focused on. So I want to tell the story of one book, and by telling this story of this book, which is quite fascinating, we'll be able to explore two men and the nexus of two stories, of two types of activism, two types of resistance that took place during the war. So far, so good? So if you want to talk more about Budapest in general, we could do that a different time. But I really want to focus on this book. The book is authored by the man who appears on the cover of your packet. His name is Rabbi Yisachar Shlomo Teichtal. Rabbi Teichtal was born in 1885 in Hungary, and he was raised in a rabbinic milieu. He was a student in the yeshiva, and he was recognized as an outstanding, prodigious student. And so at the age of 19, he had already mastered so much of Jewish learning that he became a rabbinical judge. He was appointed as a dayan at the age of 19. In 1924, he published his first volume of responsa. The title of that is in Hebrew, it's Mishnas Sachir. So here you have a great rabbinic luminary, born in Hungary, but as we'll soon see in a little bit, spends most of his life in Slovakia. If you look on the green map, as you can see, the bottom right is Hungary. The centerpiece here is Czechoslovakia. And you see where I have in the handwritten Pishtani. Pishtani was the community in which Rabbi Teichtal served as the chief rabbi for 20 years, beginning in 1921. He sets up a yeshiva there, a school for boys, and he's a renowned Torah scholar. He publishes additional volumes of his response of Mishnah Sachir. And here you have this great rabbinic luminary from Hungary. Now, at this time, when he was born, I don't want to oversimplify it, but we could say that the predominant view in Orthodox and certainly in rabbinic circles in Hungary was anti a new movement that was picking up steam in Europe in the end of the 19th century. And that was, what's that? Zionism. That's right. Zionism. Zionism was an outgrowth of several different things. You know, at the turn of the century, with Napoleon's emancipation of the Jews, a new vista of opportunities presented itself. So Jews reacted in lots of different ways, and the same thing happened in terms of the reaction, diversified reaction, in Orthodox and traditional Jewish circles. Outside the Orthodox community, many Jews assimilated, they acculturated in the face of emancipation. And then within Orthodox circles, you had those who embraced modernity in various ways. We spoke in our discussion about Berlin, about the rabbinical seminary in Berlin, the Hildesheimer Academy, Rabbi Hildesheimer, and before him, Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch. So these are people who are integrating into their Jewish life also the modern secular experience. And then you had those who rejected it out of fear that Jews would begin to lose their identity as Jews and their commitment to their tradition when things opened up for them through emancipation. That's, let's say, the first half the story in the first half of the 19th century. Yes.
When did this Zionist matter? Was it early?
This is the background. This is all the background. Until this point, Napoleon, there's no Zionism yet. 1840s and 50s, in rabbinic circles, there begins to be a discussion about a return to Israel, but it's not for another couple of decades when, especially in Eastern Europe and in Russia, very stiff pogroms and very tragic types of persecution propel or maybe accelerate discussions about how are we going to help ourselves? What's going to be the solution to the onslaught of pogroms in Eastern Europe? So there is cultural Zionism, there is political Zionism, and by the time that Herzl comes around, the response to the Dreyfus Affair is, okay, we need our own homeland, we need our own state. Some say it could be in Uganda, but most people say Uganda is not the right place. We need to go to Israel, what would become ultimately the state of Israel. At that time, you know, it's under the Turks. Later, it's going to be under the British. But the idea is that we need to take matters into our own hands. We need to pick ourselves up and go and settle in the land of Israel. For different motivations, for different people. This is the practical aspect of Zionism. So what happens? In Orthodox circles, there are different views on this because the primary movers and shakers of the Zionist movement were not religious people. Many of them were anti-religious people. So some in the religious community said, you know, although we're very committed to our religious beliefs and we're very strict about our observance, nonetheless, you know, we're not going to be deterred by the non-religious leadership. We're going to find common ground and we can work with them in the shared values that we have about building the land of Israel. They want to build the land of Israel because they want to settle, you know, they want to have a cultural home, or they want to have a political refuge, and we want to build the land of Israel because the Torah says it's a mitzvah to live in Israel, and that the Mashiach will be coming to Israel, and many other spiritual values about building and living in Israel. And there were others, many, in the European rabbinic community who said, no, no, no. They said two major things. Number one, they said, if you want to talk about bringing the redemption, you want to talk about what is in the service of Hashem, what is God looking for us right now? He's not looking for us to pick up shovels, and he's not looking for us to buy land. He's looking for us to observe the Torah and the mitzvahs. And that's it. And in the merit of the Torah and mitzvahs, the redemption will come. That's piece number one. And piece number two is, even if you think that it's a good idea to go and settle in the land of Israel, which is a good question, you know, from a mitzvah standpoint, you can't do it with these guys. If these Zionist leaders are irreligious or anti-religious, you cannot work with them. Specifically in Hungary, in the Hungarian Orthodox milieu, there was a huge emphasis on anti-Zionism. By this time, Hasidism has grown significantly throughout Eastern Europe, and many of the Hasidic dynasties in Hungary, even today, let's say there's a particular Hasidic dynasty that originated in Hungary called Satmar. Satmar has a unique view about the state of Israel from the late Tzaddik Rav Yoel Teitelbaum, who has a very specific, I would say, extreme position, a negative position regarding Zionism and the state of Israel. But even those who are not as extreme as Satmar, there are many others in the Hungarian milieu in which Rabbi Teichtal was raised and reared intellectually who were anti-Zionists. So here you have a rabbinical judge who is raised and himself a proponent of the anti-Zionist community, but then he begins to undergo a change. Now, to the extent to which this change is happening, it's difficult to say with certainty. However, there's definitely a change, and we'll see a little bit about what the controversy is. But what happens? In 1921, he becomes the rabbi of Pishtani, which is a city that was known for mineral baths, so people used to come there. He established the yeshiva. It was a well-known Jewish city. However, that lasts until 1942, when he has to run away because of the persecution. As you know, that the Germans took over the Sudetenland and then ultimately Czechoslovakia with the Munich Agreement. So the persecution of Slovakian Jews is a unique story in and of itself. We'll touch on that a little bit. But he runs, if you look on your map, he flees from Pishtani, which is where the underline is, slightly southeast to Nitra. Nitra is another small Slovakian community where he stays from the fall of 1942 until early 1943. What happens in early 1943? He runs to Budapest. So you see at the bottom right, see where Budapest is? So that's in Hungary. He spends time in Nitra in hiding, then he spends time in Budapest in hiding, and early 1943, he begins work on a book. He begins work on a book which is published on the 15th of Cheshvan, 1943. The exact date is December 23rd, 1943. And this book is published in in Budapest. He still is hiding in Budapest until 1944, when he runs away back to Slovakia. Ultimately, he is picked up there and then sent to Auschwitz. He survives Auschwitz, but as we know, with the onslaught of the Red Army, so the Auschwitz inmates were evacuated, and on a train, one of those, it wasn't a death march, I believe it was on a train, from Auschwitz, he dies in 1945. So that's the story of Rabbi Teichtal. But the book that he wrote is remarkable. The book that he wrote is what I'm holding in front of you in the Hebrew edition. This is called Eim Habanim Smecha, The Mother of the Children is Happy. Here you have, I didn't Xerox it for you because it's all in Hebrew. On the left-hand side, you're looking at, this is the handwritten notes of Rabbi Teichtal in the margins of the original Hebrew edition. And this is what's known in Yiddish as the Sharblat, the original edition, Mechubar Mimeni HaTzair Ba'alfei Yisrael, authored by me, the young in Israel, Yisachar Shlomo Teichtal, Budapest, Tavshin Gimel, 1943. So this is the front cover of the original edition of Eim Habanim Smecha, The Mother of the Children is Happy. That is the book. What is the story of Eim Habanim Smecha? And now, recently, this English edition was published. There was an English edition that was before, but as you can see, this edition is extremely long, it's very dense, and it's a lot of rabbinic Hebrew. So there was a local family here in Skokie, the name is Menorah. So Shalom Menorah and others undertook condensing this very long work into a shorter edition, which is what you have here on your, if you look in your white packets, I gave you the cover page of this, the essential Eim Habanim Smecha, which means that it's abridged. He cuts out many of the rabbinic proofs and the discussions. But what is this book about? What this book is about the importance of settling the land of Israel. Rav Teichtal does something dramatic, hard to say if it's unprecedented, but it is certainly significant. And he says, you know, I think we've made a mistake. I think we got it wrong. Instead of rejecting for all of these years the opportunity to go and settle in the land of Israel, we should have viewed it as a calling. We should have taken up that opportunity. And he marshals countless sources to the importance of settling the land of Israel, of the mitzvah of building the land of Israel, of being part of Yishuv Haaretz, what's called in Hebrew. This is from a man who initially was an anti-Zionist. This is from somebody who grew up in a milieu who said that that's not the answer. But he says, no, look what's happening to us. He's writing in 1943 because by this time, people already know what's going on, what it means, resettlement to the east. So what's amazing is that his response is to say, you know what? We need to take this as a calling, a spiritual calling that says we need to go back to Israel. Amazing. Now, if you turn the page, you have the beginning of a recently published article by a fellow by the name of Daniel Reiser in Israel called Aspects and the Thought of Rabbi Yisachar Shlomo Teichtal and a Study of New Documents. Rabbi Teichtal says, has been debated because in his son's introduction to the Eim Habanim Smecha, Rabbi Teichtal notes, Rabbi Teichtal has a son who survived the war. He says, my father wrote this book not really affiliating with any particular movement. Meaning, do not mistake my father for being a Zionist. So this becomes a big debate in the thought of Rabbi Teichtal. How much of this work about loving the land of Israel is synonymous with Zionism? Right, because all Jews, even Satmar, who are opposed, vehemently opposed to the state of Israel, love the land of Israel. That's part of being Jewish. That's part of the heritage of the Jewish people. So there is some debate, and that's what's interesting in this article. And you look in the footnotes here, I gave you just two pages. All right, maybe you need a magnifying. I wanted to condense it to save the trees. I wanted to put it. But if you look at footnotes 5 and 6, that's where he deals with the question of how Zionist was Rabbi Teichtal. How Zionist was he? So, I can't tell you, I don't have a tape measure to tell you exactly how Zionist he was, but the premise of this article is that his view of the settling the land of Israel was very much in consonance with the religious Zionist worldview. It's not just that he loved Eretz Yisrael, it's that he saw similar things in the way that the religious Zionists saw the community. Yes?
Talking about living, like a sovereign.
So, I didn't go through the entire book, and I don't remember offhand. He's definitely talking about building more than just Yishuv Haaretz. You have to look through for exact yukim, but I think the emphasis is certainly on building a nation that we should all go en masse. You know, that's one of the big distinctions between the religious Zionist philosophy and the anti-Zionist philosophy. Let's say in Satmar, they believe that there is a spiritual oath that the Jewish people is not allowed to go en masse back to the land of Israel. And that's why the state of Israel is a violation of that oath, and it's a terrible thing. Because everybody agrees that individuals can go, and individuals have gone for, you know, time immemorial. Even the days of Rishon, there were great Tosafists who went as individuals. The Chiddush of Zionism is that we should all go, and we should take that active role in bringing the redemption. Well, that's very much, at least from what I could gather, I'm not a historian, I'm not a scholar, I'm not an expert in Rav Teichtal, so that's why I brought you somebody who summarizes all of the arguments. That's the discussion that he has here, exactly how close he was to religious Zionism. But that's what's fascinating. So now, what's the backstory of this book? Yeah, Vivian?
Was he a member of the Satmar or
not? No, so he wasn't from a specific Hasidic dynasty. He was raised in a traditional Hungarian background. I don't know if his family had any ties to any, but Munkács also, which was another, maybe the major Hungarian dynasty, was also strongly anti-Zionist, the Munkács dynasty.
So he was not a Chassid.
So was he a Chassid technically? I don't know. It's a good question. His family, I can tell you, where is this? Mm-hmm. Trying to figure out whether, because he learned in, I'll tell you the teacher, the name of his teachers. His father was a Chassid and was one of the Chassidim of Sanz. Now, Sanz is not in Hungary, Sanz is in Poland, but he studied in a yeshiva in, I can't even pronounce this, in Hungary. And one of the most formal students of the Yitav Lev. He went to Galicia to learn by the cloister of the Sanz of Chassidim. So he was Chassidish. That's just to clarify that. But not from, you see, Sanz and Rupschitz and others that were also in Galicia, not just in Hungary. So what's the backstory for the title, Eim HaBonim Smecha, of this Chassidic rabbi? He says, I'll tell you a story. This appears in his introduction, and this is going to bring us to the second figure. It's interesting how he lays out the Sefer. First he has a psicha, an opening, he has a hakdama, and then he also has a hakdama shniya. So this is in the conclusion of the hakdama shniya, the second introduction. He says, you know why I called this Sefer Eim HaBonim Smecha? Because of the following story that I saw with my own eyes, Pesach 1942. He says, there was a decree in the spring of 1942, and then when you go back and study the historical context, you line it all up. There was a decree in the spring of 1942 to collect young women from the age of 16 to transport them to an unknown destination. So if you look, we'll reference this in a little bit, but this, there was a discussion, a lot of discussion about the fate of Slovakian Jews in this volume published by Yad Vashem called Years Wherein We Have Seen Evil, Volume 3. Talk about it a little bit more. So they talk about exactly what times and which people were going to be deported. So there was a whole discussion among the Slovakian government, what's going to happen if the Germans take away the young people? Well, then the older people are going to be a burden on the state. It's interesting, you don't think about how the Slovakian government dealt with this. So he says there was a decree to take away these girls to an unknown location. He says there was a huge commotion in the community what to do about this. So there was one guy who wanted to save his daughter. His daughters, I think he had, what did it say exactly? How many daughters? It was, he had two daughters. He's going to take his two daughters and smuggle them over the border. And once he gets to the other side of the border, he's going to send a telegram to his wife to let her know that he and the two daughters had escaped and they had succeeded in crossing the border. However, what happens? As they try to cross the border on Chol HaMoed Pesach, they were caught. And they were taken and incarcerated for Chol HaMoed Pesach and the last days of Pesach, the holiday of Pesach, and they were in this very dangerous situation. And he says, you can imagine what was the feeling of the mother of these two daughters. What was that Chol HaMoed Pesach like? What was the last days of Pesach like for her? For the mother. For the mother. Thinking about her husband and her daughters, crying nonstop, the tension, the stress, the nerves. They could have been killed obviously easily. And then what happens? One man intervenes. I won't tell you his name just yet. You have to wait for a second. This man intervenes and raises a ton of money to be able to ransom, to bribe, to release the man and the two daughters.
What country are they in?
Yeah,
so they crossed the border.
So he doesn't say, I'm assuming they're going from Slovakia into Hungary, but I can't say with certainty. I'm assuming that's the case, but because he doesn't tell you. He just says, La'avor es ha'gvul. So then, what happens? He says, this happened on the last days of Pesach, and immediately they sent hoda'a telefonis, a telephone message, to the mother, letting her know that her husband and two daughters had been rescued through this bribe. He says, you can't imagine, obviously, the emotion and the feeling, the joy, the celebration. You can't even describe, he says, of this woman, how she cried tears of joy. And he says, when they returned, when the girls came home, he says, if you didn't see that reunification, you never saw the kind of joy that I saw in my life. He says, Misha lo ro'es rega ha'pagisha, whoever didn't see that, and that joy, never saw happiness in their life. He says, this happened to me. I know this people. I know exactly this story. So, Eim ha'banim smecha, the mother is so happy. Think about the emotion, the feeling, the joy that this mother is experiencing when she's reunited with her children. He says, you know who the mother is? He quotes a Talmud Yerushalmi that the land of Israel is the mother of Israel.
And the angel of death has passed over their house. And it's the end of Pesach. And initially it was your firstborn, male or female.
Good. Okay, so, nice. This could make for a good drasha and shul. Very good.
But I mean, I'm sure she felt that way.
Now, he says that the mother of Israel is the land of Israel. And the land of Israel has been waiting for hundreds of years. We've been taken captive by the Crusaders, and then by the Inquisitors, and then by the Nazis, by the Germans, and the Ukrainians, and the conspirators in Slovakia. So what is the land of Israel waiting for? Waiting for us to come home. That's the message. That's the message. The message is, we need to come home. So that's the beautiful story behind the title of this book. But what you have here is the meeting of two men. You have the author of this book, Rav Shlomo Yisachar Teichtal. But then you have a person, a man, who he mentions who was responsible for the ransom. The man was a rabbi in a town called Nitra. The chief rabbi of Nitra. Wait a second. We saw Nitra before. He ran to Nitra. He knew this man. The man's name was Rav Shmuel David Unger. Unger. Rav Shmuel David Unger, which is not an uncommon Hungarian Hasidic name. Rav Shmuel David Unger was the chief rabbi of, and the Rosh Yeshiva, of Nitra. The Nitra Hasidim, by the way, if you want to find the Nitra Hasidim today, you go to Mount Kisco in Westchester, New York, where you will find the Nitra Hasidim and the rebuilt Nitra Yeshiva after the destruction by the Germans. Right. Yes, that is right. I've been in Mount Kisco. So here you have two, the nexus, what we were talking about, is the two men who are crossing paths, two aspects of spiritual resistance crossing paths. The first is the transformation of this Hungarian rabbi, of Rav Teichtal, from anti-Zionist to someone who's celebrating and emphasizing the return to the land of Israel, perhaps even close to religious Zionism, and another form of resistance in the same context, and that is bribery. Activism on behalf of Rav Unger, and as we'll see, even more expanded by his son-in-law, Rabbi Michal Ber Weissmandel, which is the next page in your packet. Here you have the biography, the brief biography of Rav Michal Ber Weissmandel. Rabbinic authority, is born in 1903 in Hungary and moves as a young man to Slovakia, where he becomes a student of Rav Shmuel David Unger. By the way, Rabbi Unger survives most of the war, but dies in hiding from exhaustion and starvation from the effects of the war. He dies in 1945, in February 22nd, 1945, not long before the liberation. He dies in February, the liberation is going to come just a few months later. So Rabbi Unger has this major yeshiva, which in 1931 is in Nitra, in Slovakia, and he has a student. His chief pupil is Rav Michal Ber Weissmandel. In 1937, Rav Michal Ber Weissmandel marries the daughter of, her name is Bracha Leah, of the Nitra Rosh Yeshiva. And in 1937, as his son-in-law, he becomes essentially the right-hand man of Rabbi Unger. So much so that Rabbi Unger is ill. In 1942, he delivers the sermon, the lecture, in the middle of the war. So this is already an amazing confluence, which we could talk about, of spiritual leadership during the war, both from Rav Teichtal and from Rav Weissmandel. Those could be full lectures in and of themselves. But what I wanted to focus on most interestingly is that here too you have a transformation. Because at the beginning, Rabbi Weissmandel, under the mentoring of his father-in-law, Rabbi Unger, was very involved in activities, in refugee activities, in rescue activities for Jews. To read more about this, you want to take a look in a couple of places. You want to look in this, Shnos Ra'inu Ra, this is the English edition, Years Wherein We Have Seen Evil, and this is the Hebrew volume that he wrote. It's called Min HaMeitzar. It was edited by his students, but he prepared it before his death. He died in 1956. It was published, I think, first published in 1960. There is an English, I guess, version of this published by Art Scroll called The Unheeded Cry, but this is the original. It's always good to see things in the original.
Is that a psalm?
It's based on a verse in Tehillim, in Psalms, yes. This is actually, in the back of this volume, it's very fascinating. They collect original documents that he was using. He was one of the men who was active in trying to get the word out about Auschwitz and the bombing of Auschwitz For those who have ever been to Hyde Park, New York, and the Presidential Library of FDR, there's one little note there in the Presidential Library of FDR that notes that there was a great controversy. They even write this in FDR's library, in his house. There's a great controversy. You saw it? About whether or not the Allies should or should not have bombed Auschwitz. Well, who was active in getting the word out? There were several people, including there were two survivors of Auschwitz who came out and wrote diagrams of what things looked like. So you're looking at the picture of the diagram that I'm holding in my hand right here, and Rav Michael Ber Weissmandl was active in getting these diagrams and descriptions to Switzerland to be sent out to the free world. He was an extremely active person. But what's interesting is that at the beginning of his activism, at the beginning of the war, he did not participate in something that later became known as the Working Group. The Working Group was an underground group of resistance. Primarily, many of them were secular people, and many of them were Zionists. And Rabbi Weissmandl did not become involved in that group. But in 1942, as things got worse, he became connected and became more involved and ultimately joined and became one of the leaders of this working group. Who was in charge of the working group? A Zionist woman by the name of Gisi Fleischman. Gisi Fleischman had been an active Zionist since the 1930s. Her father had been, I think, either a rabbi or a religious person. I'm not sure if she was religious or not. I don't know. Her daughters had moved to Israel, Palestine at that time, but she stayed in Slovakia to be involved in supporting. Ultimately, she was killed. She was deported and murdered in Auschwitz, I think, in 1944. But she was the leader of the working group. And here, too, you have a transformation. Whereas even though at the beginning of the war, Rav Michael Ber Weissmandl and the Nitra Rav were not interested in working with him, but then, over time, when he built a measure of trust, he happened to be a cousin of this Gisi Fleischman. So there was some connection there. But he became an extremely active member of this group, primarily of Zionists, who were trying to rescue Jews in all different kinds of way. And in particular, one of the most interesting things that they did, and it's not the only case of this, but it's maybe the most prominent case, was bribery. So he was involved, Rav Michael Ber Weissmandl, was involved in July and August of 1942 of bribing the German officer who was the second in command, who was like Eichmann's Slovakian representative. His name is Will Zitsky.
Is it Dieter Wistesen?
Yeah, I don't know how to pronounce it.
May I interrupt you,
please? Yes, please.
That's the same guy that Eichmann sent to Thessaloniki.
Yes.
And he was in charge of the deportation.
That's right. So
I'm looking at his name and going, oh my God.
Yes, he was later sent to Greece to deport all of, and he was killed. He was killed. He was put to death after the war, after he gave a lot of testimony to the Nuremberg trials, and that testimony, for those who wanted Eichmann shout out, so this guy, I forget, how do you pronounce his name?
Wislisending.
I don't know how to pronounce it. However you say it, so he was approached by the working group and was paid several thousand U.S. dollars to haul transports. Now, then there became a debate, and there's still a debate apparently among historians, whether or not this bribe was over 20,000 U.S. dollars that was paid to the Germans to stop the deportations, whether or not this was effective or not. Because even though there were some deportations in the fall of 1942, the deportations stopped until into 1944. So some claim it was the act of the working group that was successful in forestalling at least to some degree. Others say no, it was just because it worked out better for the Germans to use their resources elsewhere. So there is some debate. But what's interesting is here you have a Hungarian rabbi, a Rosh Yeshiva, who is working hand in hand with a group of Zionists. And not only working with them, being innovative. And then comes the most innovative, the most bold suggestion, what became known as the Europa Plan, that Rav Michael Ber Weissmandl was involved in coming up with this idea that they approached the Germans in October of 1942 with the offer of paying them $2 million U.S. dollars to essentially buy out the rest of the Jews of Europe. This was in October of 1942, and then negotiations went on for some time until 1943, the Germans send a message back, they're not interested. Now, whether or not the Germans ever took this seriously is an open question. That's a question. Europa plan. Europa plan. And this was not just to save Slovakian Jews. This was to save tons of Jews, millions of Jews, potentially. Now, it didn't come to fruition, and Weissmandl was extremely bitter about the fact that certain groups, whether they were Zionists in Palestine or through the Joint or others outside, were not as forthcoming or not forthcoming enough, quickly enough, with money to help him. And maybe that's why this plan fell apart. Maybe that's why the deportations, who knows. So it does not succeed. But isn't this an amazing story, which is often not told, of a great rabbinic luminary who is going around spending money to ransom people? And the nexus of these two figures, of Rav Weissmandl / Rabbi Unger and Rabbi Teichtal, is in this book, is in the Eim HaBonim Smecha. Because you see, it was Rabbi Unger and Rabbi Weissmandl that they were successful in individual cases of ransoming Jews, of rescuing them, of bringing them back home. And this resistance, it's not just spiritual resistance, actual resistance. It continues because in 1944, in September 7, 1944, Rabbi Weissmandl and his wife and five children were arrested. They were in hiding. They were arrested in Slovakia and they were sent to Auschwitz. On the way to Auschwitz, he's faced with a terrible moral dilemma, what to do. He has a choice. Should he stay on the train with his family or should he make an escape? He was able to break out of the car through a wooden board and jump from the train when no one saw him. He makes his way back to Slovakia and joins the underground again. His wife and five children are sent to Auschwitz and they're killed. He comes back and he goes to Daven Slichus, the prayers between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. He goes back to his religious life and to his resistance life. Then he gets caught again, and he is again sent to a camp. This time, he's not sent to Auschwitz. He's sent, I think it was called Sered, which was one of the local war concentration camps in Slovakia. But due to help from a fellow by the name of Kastner, some of you are familiar with this from the Kastner transport from 1944. It was somewhat of a controversial story, but Kastner was a Zionist leader who was involved in also ransoming and getting people out. Kastner was able to get Rabbi Weissmandl out on Chol HaMoed Pesach in 1945 to get him to Switzerland. After the war, where does he go? He goes back to Nitra. But then, after nothing materializes there, he's done everything he could. He ultimately settles in America and dies in 1957. So to summarize, this meeting in Budapest, in this book, Eim HaBonim Smecha, is the confluence of two stories, of two rabbis, from strong Hungarian and Slovakian Jewish communities, who through the experience of the war, changed their position, or looked at things differently, or experienced things differently. They didn't abandon their religious life, but they modified, they became new in terms of their approach, and how they dealt either with the Land of Israel, the Zionist movement, or in dealing with Zionists and being active in terms of working in other groups like the working group. So both Rav Teichtal and Rav Weissmandl underwent this transformation as religious people through the experience of the war. And it all, I would say it all comes together for this book, which was published in Budapest in 1943. And the amazing thing is, and with this we'll close, is that this book is not an academic book that sits on a shelf somewhere that only people look at when they're looking to do research. The work Eim HaBonim Smecha has become a very important work for those students of religious Zionism and for those who love the Land of Israel and who are looking to enrich their lives. So this book is a living document. There are people in this room whose children are the living embodiment of this work because they have seen the importance of picking up, if possible, and actually making that move to live in Eretz Yisrael. So the idea that we're studying a historical context of this book is meant to just give greater appreciation to the fact that the book is still alive and the people who embody its teachings today living in the Land of Israel, building the Land of Israel, building the State of Israel in the spirit of this idea of hopefully bringing the redemption closer. And whatever, you know, whatever point on that continuum, you're going to view it. So I thank you for listening, and I'll give you one more landmark, which we've referenced before, but it's good to know because she mentions this in different contexts. We focus today specifically on Rav Teichtal's teachings as it relates to Israel, but he has a lot of other writings that relate to many other aspects of religious life in the Shoah, so you'll find them, some of them here in Esther Farbstein's book, Hidden in Thunder, mostly in Volume 1, but also she has references to Rav Weissmandl. And of course, each one of these stories, especially if you want to talk about ransom and, you know, bribery and the ethical and moral dilemmas there, you know, that was a big part of the Kastner controversy, that he was able to get Jews out, but he had saved his family. Did that mean he was letting other people die? You know, these are all halachic questions, Jewish questions that we could think about maybe for a future session. But today, as long as you walk away with these two people, Rabbi Weissmandl and Rabbi Teichtal, put them on your map and be inspired by that transformation. We can all grow. It's never too late to re-examine how you understand any aspect of your life, and that's what they did during their experience in the war.